Their goal is to win without going to war, to achieve their objectives by breaking our willpower, using attacks below the threshold that would prompt a warfighting response. These attacks on our way of life from authoritarian rivals and extremist ideologies are remarkably difficult to defeat without undermining the very freedoms we want to protect. We are exposed through our openness.
This is General Sir Nick Carter, head of the UK Armed Forces. Speaking at the Policy Exchange think tank, General Carter sounded a grave warning. The UK and its allies are operating in a rapidly changing world. And while a focus on counterinsurgency operations may have dominated the early years of the century, attention has now shifted to the threat posed by China and Russia. These authoritarian rivals view the strategic context as a continuous struggle in which non-military and military instruments can be used, unconstrained by any distinction between peace and war. China and Russia are also exploiting what they see as fundamental weaknesses in Western warfighting methods, which is forcing a comprehensive transformation of the UK armed forces.
Their way of warfare is strategic. It is synchronized and it is systematic, and our response must be too.
This is Shepherd Studios podcast series on Five Eyes connectivity, sponsored by our partner, Viasat. In this second series, we're exploring the military connectivity issues facing the Five Eyes nations and looking at the work underway to ensure communication networks can withstand the expected threats of tomorrow. Last time, we discovered how a new focus on joint all-domain operations is dominating future thinking on warfare for the US military and its allies. In today's episode, we focus on the UK and hear how a rapidly shifting threat environment is driving a transformation of British military capabilities. As General Carter puts it, the British military is moving from an industrial age of platforms to an information age of systems. The UK's rivals have carefully studied the Western way of war, identifying vulnerabilities and modernising their own capabilities to target these weaknesses. They learned that air power could penetrate deep into hostile territory and that Western militaries preferred to strike targets from afar.
They saw that this enhanced our natural aversion to putting people in harm's way. They watched how casualties, financial cost, and length of time swayed domestic and public opinion, and the effect that that had on the legitimacy assuring the use of armed force. So they learned how to improve their own resilience to absorb strikes. They developed anti-access denial systems. They improved their maritime undersea capabilities. They developed long-range missile systems. They integrated electronic warfare, swarms of drones with multiple fires, and used these to defeat armor. They invested in space and cyber, recognizing the importance we attach to global positioning and digitization. And in Ukraine and Syria, Russia has created battle laboratories from real-life events to develop their tactics and battle-harden a new generation of soldiers.
General Carter also pointed to the Pentagon's latest report on military and security developments in China. This outlines how the People's Liberation Army has been strengthened and modernized over the past two decades, including growing the largest maritime surface and subsurface battle force in the world.
An armory of ground-launched cruise and ballistic missiles, some of which have 10 times the range of conventional ballistic missiles. One of the world's largest forces of advanced long-range surface-to-air systems, and of course expanding their overseas military footprint. China's new strategic support force is designed to achieve dominance in the space and cyber domains. It commands satellite information attack and defense forces, electronic assault forces, and internet assault forces, campaign information operations forces, which include conventional electronic warfare forces, anti-radiation assault forces, and battlefield cyber warfare forces, All of this is available in the open domain.
Beyond this broader strategic picture, what's driving the focus on peer rivals from a British standpoint? Here's Andrew White, a freelance defence journalist and Shepherd contributor.
Certainly in Eastern Europe, coalition forces and NATO forces are day-to-day suffering from Russian information operations, which are disrupting command and control communications at the tactical edge. The British Army is no stranger to this. You know, they have a battle group formation in Estonia, which is operating as part of the NATO enhanced force presence. And they also have troops in Poland. So it's very much at the cutting edge of emerging operational requirements, which are designed to overcome this disturbance in communications by Russia. Examples can include a low probability of intercept, a low probability of detection communications, cyber defense, and a real emphasis on PACE communication plans. And that's PACE stands for primary, alternative, contingency, and emergency communications networks. And all this really at a time when they're looking to reduce their reliance on space-based communications like TACSAT, and introducing historic but relatively new technologies, including wideband HF, for example.
We are now entering an era of multi-domain operations with close integration between military services and across domains, including space and cyber. Against this backdrop, China and Russia are trying to exploit what they see as fundamental weaknesses in Western warfighting methods. Here's Franz-Stefan Gardi, Fellow for Cyberspace and Future Conflict at the IISS, the Institute for International Strategic Studies.
China and Russia have really been working on operational concepts to break this idea of the Western way of war, or disrupt this idea of the Western way of war built around joint operations and superior technological capabilities. And China, for example, has specifically been working on this concept of systems destruction warfare, which is specifically tailored to exploit vulnerabilities of Western C4ISR networks. And Russia is also doing something similar, but perhaps with a different emphasis. Moscow's conception of network-centric warfare is really more devoted to disabling specifically the command grip within an adversary's network architecture, and not really the entire system, like in the case of China.
It's clear, then, that Western powers such as the UK are faced with a very different world, even when compared with the environment of 5 or 10 years ago. But what does this mean in practice? Here's Ken Peterman, President of Government Systems at Viasat, a company specializing in secure communications.
The US and Five Eyes countries collectively, I think, are confronting the reality that the world is a different place than it was 5 years or 10 years ago. If you think of coming out of World War II, the US and the Western powers have been able to project force anywhere in the world. They've been able to establish military dominance anywhere in the world in a matter of a few weeks or a few months. And they've done that, and they've been able to employ concepts like precision strike, which avoided fratricide and avoided collateral damage and that kind of thing. And the way they've done that is they have largely relied on very exquisite, expensive platforms like a JSTARS or a AWACS or a military satellite or GPS or a variety of other technologies. These are very exquisite and sophisticated technologies that collectively form a part of this defense ecosystem of how we project force and project power around the world and do it in a way that is as humane as that can be done. Okay. In a peer adversary environment, which the emergent world and the emergent landscape is more of a peer threat environment, where a peer adversary has the resources and the military capabilities to take those exquisite platforms that the DoD relies on, to take them away, okay? Because each of them represents a single point failure in this defense infrastructure. A military satellite, a GPS satellite, a particular aircraft, or another asset that might be a single point failure in this DoD ecosystem. A peer adversary, they're realizing, confronting the reality that a peer adversary can take those single point failures away And when they take them away, it completely devastates our ability to conduct the kinds of operations and to assert the projection of power and the assertion of dominance that we've been accustomed to doing. It even creates a situation where the homeland might be threatened in a way that's never been threatened in our memory as through two or three generations of residents of these Western countries.
This evolving threat presents new challenges for the UK. In his speech to Policy Exchange, General Carter outlined how Britain's adversaries don't recognise the rule of law. Pervasive information and emerging technologies have enabled new tools and techniques that undermine cohesion, while remaining below traditional detection and response thresholds. As the UK looks to counter this, more of the same will not be enough. Instead, the MOD is turning to an integrated operating concept, which is formed of several key ideas. First, it makes a distinction between operating and warfighting, as the General explains.
In an era of persistent competition, our deterrent posture needs to be more dynamically managed and modulated. This concept therefore introduces a fifth C, that of competition, to the traditional deterrence model of comprehension, credibility, capability, and communication. This recognises the need to compete below the threshold of war in order to deter war and to prevent one's adversaries from achieving their objectives in fait accompli strategies, as we've seen in the Crimea, Ukraine, Libya, and further afield. Competing involves a campaign posture that includes continuous operating on our terms and in places of our choosing. This requires a mindset that thinks in several dimensions to escalate and de-escalate up and down multiple ladders, as if it were a spider's web. One might actively constrain in the cyber domain to protect critical national infrastructure in the maritime domain. This campaign posture must be dynamically managed, and there must be a preparedness to allocate consistent means over longer-term horizons while adjusting the ways to anticipate a rival's response. The ways will include actions being communicated in a manner that may well test the traditional limits of statecraft. This posture will be engaged and forward deployed. Armed forces much more in use rather than dedicated solely for contingency, with training and exercising being delivered as operations. It will involve capacity building and engagement in support of countries that need our support. This could include partnered operations against common threats, particularly violent extremism, and this may well involve combat operation. It will also place a premium on building alliances and improving interoperability to make us more allied by design and thus able to burden share more productively. It is important to emphasise that the willingness to commit decisively hard capability with the credibility to warfight is an essential part of the ability to operate and therefore of deterrence. The second important idea is that we cannot afford any longer to operate in silos. We have to be integrated with allies, as I have described, across government, as a national enterprise, but particularly across the military instrument. Effective integration of maritime, land, air, space, and cyber achieves a multi-domain effect that adds up to far more than simply the sum of the parts. Recognizing, to paraphrase Omar Bradley, that the overall effect is only as powerful as the strength of the weakest domain. And third, we have to modernize. We must chart a direction of travel from an industrial age of platforms to an information age of systems. Warfare is increasingly about a competition between hiding and finding. It will be enabled at every level by a digital backbone into which all sensors, effectors, and deciders will be plugged. This means that some industrial age capabilities will increasingly have to meet their sunset to create the space for capabilities needed for sunrise. The trick is how you find a path through the night.
This shifting technological picture, the move from sunset to sunrise technologies, is at the heart of the multi-domain integration concept. Ken Peterman points to the increasing reliance on swarms of assets, whether they are sensors, satellites, or weapons, which avoids the risk of single points of failure.
We're moving toward swarms of very affordable, but very attritable assets, which means that we're disaggregating these exquisite single point failures into very affordable, smaller assets that can act as swarms, such that if an adversary takes out 20% of them or 50% of them or 80% of them, it no longer disrupts our ability to conduct an effective military operation that keeps our young men and women in uniform safe at the same time they're able to accomplish their objective. So as we move toward this disaggregated swarm type of assets, and those swarms of assets could be sensor assets, communications assets, they could be weapons, they could be any of that kind of thing. The fundamental technology that is the enabler for this transformational change in the defense infrastructure, the fundamental enabler is connectivity. Connectivity among these swarms of assets that can be assured connectivity. It's resistant to cyber threats. It has to be affordable. It has to have enormously high bandwidth. It has to be able to be small and lightweight in terms of the appliance that goes on to these different assets that are operating in these swarms. And it has to be assured, and it has to be global.
The UK Strategic Command is spearheading the development of greater cross-domain integration. This will see better integration across traditional service stovepipes and bringing such integration to a deeper, more tactical level. Here's Franz-Stefan Gardi again.
Really, the idea behind all of this is really to make this new idea of multi-domain operations, which is in essence, in my opinion, really just synchronized combined arms operations across really all the warfighting domains and services, and particularly space and cyberspace, as well as the electromagnetic spectrum, just much better and better integrated. And I think the right command and control structure here is key, because you can't really have multi-domain operations without a so-called real-time common operating picture. In other words, a picture providing the commanding officer with a situational awareness of everything that is happening in the battle space, including troop movements, weapon systems, and other platforms as well. And I think this is really key, as well as all electromagnetic missions and other ongoing cyber operations against specific networks in the battle space. So I think the key to reorganizing around this idea of multi-domain operations in the UK, but also perhaps in other countries, is really this idea of deeper integration of cyberspace and information warfare capabilities really across service stovepipes in, for example, permanent joint headquarters or standing joint forces headquarters, which is really how the UK armed forces are structuring this.
To have a real-time common operating picture in the context of multi-domain integration, it is essential to include a strong focus on the cyber and electromagnetic dimension.
The principal idea behind all of this, and I think this is something that's often not mentioned, is that really in order to implement multi-domain operations or this new form of warfighting, really, because that's what it really is, it's this idea of information dominance. That is, by having superior information about the battle space than the adversary, you have a decision advantage and consequently can really move faster and outmaneuver your adversary. So I think specifically, what are the UK armed forces doing when it comes to command and control or new command and control concepts? They're currently experimenting with a lot of stuff, new concepts around, for example, a more collaborative C2 approach where the commander is supported by a number of staff or controllers included in the decision-making loop, supporting him or her in coming up with a particular course of action, really to a more distributed edge command and control architecture, which is really, I think, where all of this is heading, which is built around a more robust battle management system that enables the commander to make decisions faster without consulting his superiors at all time. And I think what's key here is that this will not just require new technologies, but also require changes in military culture. And specifically here, I mean, perhaps we need to be rethinking this idea of mission command also. just because as a result of this new operational environment that the UK armed forces might be facing in the future when they go into combat against the near peer or peer competitor, where really the entire C2 environment can be massively degraded by disruptions and so forth and particular activities of the adversary. We really need to think about how to really change this idea of mission command from a centralized decision-making concept to decentralized execution to a more decentralized decision-making to decentralized executions.
At the core of this evolution is the move towards a military Internet of Things, which will enable the collection, processing, and distribution of information across multiple platforms. This will help ensure a decisive information advantage, but must be handled carefully.
We need to think much more about inserting resiliency and redundancy in all of this, because it is an extremely fragile concept, in my opinion. And I say fragile because I think in the long term, we won't be able to achieve any of this without really new technological capabilities that remain somewhat underdeveloped. For example, you really need artificial enabled decision-making support that helps you filter all this information and deconflict all these different weapon systems, platforms, and direct networks with one another. Because even if we give authority to the guy on the edge to execute a particular mission, it's going to be extremely difficult for this person to really figure out what he can do and can't do in the battle space if he doesn't really know what's happening to the left and right of him. This is particularly true when it comes to operations in the electromagnetic spectrum and offensive cyber capabilities. If we think that at some point people in the lower echelons, will be able to execute or will have the authority to execute these missions, which I think they have to, otherwise it doesn't really make any sense to push these decisions out there. And you can have all kinds of conflicting, deconflicting issues. So I think it will not be possible to entirely have this command and control on the edge without not some sort of link. So I think this idea of a military Internet of Things will be instrumental, but it needs to be a secure network. And I think this is really sort of a principal issue with all of this, the fragility of all of these new ideas behind this future war fighting, this new idea of future war fighting.
There are several terms used to describe the military concepts currently in development. Last episode, for example, we heard about the Pentagon's development of its joint all-domain command and control concept. Terms such as prototype warfare also play a key role in British thinking. Here's Andrew White outlining some of the major programs the British Army is focusing on.
A lot hinges on the publication of the Integrated Review. Certainly from the point of view of the British Army, there are lots of avenues being explored at the moment. And another one of the key nomenclatures being banded around is the joint all-domain command and control requirements, which has kind of arisen out of the US, but is now seeing some traction in the UK. Also, the CGS's description of prototype warfare has huge capability for command and control and communications for the army. And basically this looks at the rapid exploitation of emerging technologies and urgent operational requirements with, you know, again, depending on the integrated review, potential for the implementation of a digital backbone and a cloud technology, which would enable the army to exploit fourth industrial revolution technologies. Everything from machine learning, artificial intelligence, 5G, 6G communications, quantum computing, etc. The list goes on. So areas of interest include mounted and dismounted close combat networking, some huge procurement of tactical ground vehicles coming out for the army, which will be critical to supporting those requirements. Also, NATO and Five Eye interoperability with key partner forces. Security domains on the battlefield, again, ties in with the requirement for a tactical cloud. Mil-spec GPS and generic soldier and vehicle architectures. So those are the key areas the Army is looking for moving forward.
Recognizing that information is power, the British Armed Forces are working to deliver information into the hands of users, wherever they are, wherever they need it, and whatever their role.
So the British Army's primary focus is the LATACSIS program, which stands for the Land Environment Tactical Communications and Information Systems program. This features a series of sub-programs which are aimed at providing the Army with a next-generation tactical military communications system in the land environment. The main focus of LATACSIS is to provide units with the ability to make informed and timely decisions, which are enabled by agile communication information systems. So sub-programs include BSIP 5.6, which is the Bowman Combat Infrastructure Platform, to upgrade that to basically as far as it can go before transitioning into the LATACSIS program. We have Morpheus, which we'll come on to shortly, Trinity, the Joint Common Remote Viewing Terminal, Dismounted Soldier Awareness, Falcon, and Niobe, and these are all supported by various support logistics programs. The main effort really of LATACSIS in terms of the Army is Morpheus, which is scheduled to replace the legacy Bowman radio sets currently being used by the Army in Eastern Europe and elsewhere.
A key focus for the British Armed Forces is information manoeuvre. This is defined as the use of information in all its forms to understand the operating environment better than anyone else and to then make the most of that advantage. Gary Waterfall is Senior Defence Advisor for Clarion Defence and Security, organisers of the DSEI exhibition, and a retired RAF Air Vice Marshal.
The amount of data that is out there in the world is something like, you know, all the data that's been produced up to the end of last year. We're about to double that in the next 2 years. How do you harness all that data? And not only how do you harness it, how do you give it to the warfighter at the right moment to allow him to be then, you know, having information advantage and then to close with the enemy and to end that conflict? Now, as soon as I say close with the enemy, you've probably got in your mind someone rushing forward with his bayonet or closing in with his air-to-surface munition. Actually, it might not be. It's the warrior on the keyboard that actually is outmaneuvering, changing a debate that might be going on social media to outmaneuver because he can, through information maneuver, deliver that information advantage. Because no one really wants to go out and take life. No one really wants to go out and cause casualties on the battlefield if you can get to the point that through coercion, you're playing down that conflict. And that, again, talks to the integrated operating concept. That, again, talks to multi-domain integration. And I think what I would say is we're in the baby steps of that, but we're being met with this torrent of data that's always coming in. And I think there's a reach here into wider education and preparation, because actually the people we want maybe in the services of tomorrow and the day after are those people that, at a preference, will spend their time in their room tinkering on the computer than they will playing around outside. And I think the STEM program we've got in the UK is really good on that.
The introduction of so-called sunrise technology capabilities in UK defence must be supported through collaboration with industry. This will depend on innovative approaches, often supported by non-traditional suppliers.
I think all the services are thirsty for it and they've got the budget to be innovative. And I think the message there is you're reaching further down into that supply chain. It doesn't need to be the big company. It can be the young, the innovative, the very tech-minded company. And I think what we'll see once more at DSEI is we're going to see industry reaching out to defence and defence reaching out to industry of areas that they need help, they need collaboration. I think a great example of this now, in terms of you talked about the sunrise capabilities, you know, Tempest. You know, Tempest, is Tempest going to be a platform, or is it an amalgamation of future technologies that hopefully will be in the next generation fighter? I definitely think it's the latter. And by doing so, you've got a collaborative venture, not only in UK, but around other partners in Europe. And that is going to deliver a whole bunch of concepts and realities that don't have to wait for Tempest, because what we can do is bring them forward into today's technology. In other areas of the Sunrise capabilities, apart from space and apart from cyber, what about hosting applications on tanker aircraft? Tanker aircraft are always going to be in the same vicinity as fast jets, in the same way that RFA replenishment ships for the Navy. What capabilities can you host on board those larger platforms from a sensing and an awareness perspective, or a rebroadcasting perspective? And where we thought traditionally it's been in the stovepipe of, oh, no, that's an air tanker. Now, and the Rapid Capabilities Office with an air command have already done some work on this, in a hosting a rebroadcasting capability and an intelligent capability to help the soldiers on the ground, the sailors, and indeed, you know, the airmen and the airwomen, you know, in the air with their fighter or their reconnaissance aircraft. So Sunrise capabilities, yes, most definitely. And it's going to take across the whole facet of warfighting. And we haven't gone into yet remotely crewed submersibles, land vehicles, ships, and aircraft, which, of course, you can now more and more so to make sure that you're intelligently looking across that battle space and you're taking a risk-based approach, harnessing it with technology to put the right person at the right time or the right bit of kit in the right place.
There is clearly a need for a close relationship between industry and government, but a key aspect is ensuring the Ministry of Defence is supporting innovation across the defence supply chain.
So I think within the UK approach to innovation across the whole of government is now starting to encourage those younger companies, the more innovative companies, to get onto the stage. As a relatively new guy on board with Clarion as the senior defence advisor, I've been really pleasantly surprised to see how joined up the approach is, taking DSEI as the example, working with Defence and Security Organisation from within the sort of the UKTI about how they want to bolster and get alongside the UK companies to allow them to stand on the stage. And then, of course, that's connected within wider Whitehall thinking and is connected in with the Ministry of Defence. So what you then have as this this exhibition in next September isn't competitive across the UK landscape. It very much is the whole of UK, from a defence, from government and industry, standing there collectively and collaboratively on the stage, talking about how they're coming across the multi-domain problem, how they're harnessing themselves, which in itself is a great expose of the success of it. And it's back to, for me, the real, you know, there used to be a big fascination about kit, the tanks, the aircraft, and the ships. It's now more about that supply chain, more about those people that sometimes would, if they're lucky, end up in a subprime position, but allowing them to bring their intellect to the fore and have an equal part in the debate.
It's clear that the new integrated operating concept and other strategic evolutions will impact the way that the MOD and armed forces operate. Industry must be prepared to adapt. Here's Steve Beeching, Managing Director of Viasat's UK business.
When you look at industry's perspective and our perspective, I think part of the challenge to be faced beyond this vision is this deep change of behaviours within government and MOD to reflect the strategic integration kind of defence review and these demands that's coming from it. You know, if they get that right, they're going to deliver more value, more capacity, that they're going to focus on the technology and the demands that's going to make a difference to these missions. I think personally, as industry, there's an opportunity to save billions of dollars and get the right solutions into the hands of our service people in much faster times than they currently do. But to do that, they've got to take a stand back and simplify a lot of the complexity of their organisation. And they've got to turn the process on its head somewhat to start asking questions more around what's the mission that we're trying to deliver, rather than what's the technology and the solutions that we're trying to procure. And I think once those behavioural change begin to come embedded, then I think they're going to get to this vision that they have much, much faster.
The move to introduce Sunrise capabilities will be driven by increased data management demands and applications, which are key to the modern age of information-centric warfare.
As you stand back and you look at this further, you've kind of got this tsunami of technology approaching upon us. And this relentless innovation is showing no signs of slowing down. And I think to some extent it's placing a huge burden on the existing programs and existing MOD of how it integrates those. And the days of the Bernard Gray platform-centric driven procurement doesn't really reflect that. Also, to some degree, you overlay that on the fact that they're trying to specify the technology rather than the missions. And so therefore, they keep reiterating trying to define the perfect solution, which often delays the platform they're going for. But that has a double whammy. It obviously means they get to theater for this informatic-centric warfare a lot slower than they want to, but it means that the existing solutions are going through a huge amount of obsolescence. So when you add those two things up, it's creating a huge burden on the people and on the business of being MOD defence, but on the troops on the front line as well. And I guess I would argue that the fourth industrial revolution that's here, it's not vital for MOD to have a deep understanding of the technology, but it is vital for industry to have a deep understanding of the operations. Because as we do that, we start to look at specifying things that meet the mission rather than trying to design things that meets a technology that's continually spiraling. That means the investments made by MOD and industry and partnership begin to focus on those future operations. It starts to find elements that become sustainable. And I think it also helps understand that a lot of the visions that are being discussed are actually deliverable many, many years ago. So really it's about putting those in the hands of the troops, of the warfighters, and letting them actually experiment and play with them that starts to deliver this accelerated curve and these force multipliers. But a lot of times the understanding just isn't there. To drive this incremental innovation.
This underlines the need for fundamental changes within the procurement process, with the MOD working more closely with industry to solve future capability challenges.
In my view, being an impatient industrial person, I would say that things are moving slow. I think the vision is there, but it runs into these behavioural context. You know, we come back to that point again. When you've got this tsunami of technology approaching and you've kind of got this oxymoron of trying to create perfect specifications, we're going to continue to fail to deliver what's required. When we focus on scoring tenders on technology and price rather than mission capabilities, I think, you know, we're going to collectively fail. And I think we've got to break this trust barrier whereby industry puts its arm around and begins to deliver it. So, and then as you start to stand back, you start to say, OK, so what's a new paradigm? What's coming? It's how do we create these assured, resilient, integrated networks across the battle space that's delivering communications, that's delivering data, that's delivering apps in this process of evergreen evolution? Take a step back from big bang program delivery and talk about bite-sized innovation incrementally spun. You know, we talked about the strategic defence review that's coming and the opportunity to save billions of pounds and accelerate the delivery. But, you know, we've gone through COVID-19 and the program's been restricted to a year. And a lot of people view that as a challenge. But in many ways, it's a great opportunity because it starts to get us to this point of saying, how do we create bite-sized innovation within a year that's sustainable, that spirals into the wider defence climate? So perhaps some of these changes, whilst seeming hard, are the elements that will eventually drive this change in what we need to do. So as I stand back and I look at it, You know, I think it's about making sure that mod understand the technology that's there, but really focus them on the missions. I think it's starting to evaluate based on behavior, based on the required capability, start to do early selections based on the ideas that industry provide. I think in this modern world as much more of an ecosystem, and then start to run, you know, true deep spiral development assessment centers that proves the solutions and proves this trust-weighted environment. That moves into scoring tenders competitively to meet proper procurement rules, you know, around the weights of the mission achievement. It's no point buying something because it's cheaper and technically correct if actually the specification doesn't end up delivering the mission outcome, which I think is a real danger today. And I think that's the way it needs to move. We see small movements, but I think there's so much tied into existing platforms that this change of behavior is, it's a challenge. And perhaps it starts with picking out 7-8 different programs in these austere times and these 1-year cost reviews and begin to really attack at what the art of the possible is in delivering those mission threads, in really selecting criteria, in driving some agile spiral assessments and taking those in tandem to the front line in many places and letting industry see the feedback from those to deliver the solution rather than put in paper promises or get stuck waiting for the deeper platforms to arrive.
It's clear that the MOD is looking to innovative technologies and programs as it addresses the future operating environment and the growing threat from peer rivals. But what does this mean in practical terms, and how will this evolve in the future? Here, the private sector can play a part. Steve Beeching highlights the work Viasat is carrying out for NATO's Allied Rapid Reaction Corps headquarters in the UK, known as ARC.
So as we stand back, you start at the very beginning with things like the Assured Resilient Integrated Network. People often talk about networks of networks, but at the heart of it, it's trying to foster the understanding to create an architecture that allows the five domains and all forms of deployment and engagement to cohesively work together. So we often talk about our ARIN network, this Assured Resilient Integrated Network, which moves everything from frontline tactical deployed that allows them to be merged together into greater warfighting capability, but it's moving data across multiple bearers, whether that be LTE, SATCOM, radio, or other modes of communications in a seamless, integrated way, so that each of the commanders and each of the, you know, the service people have access to a common operating picture. It's about providing the tools that our youth are used to today and are commonly knowledge of, you know, same as their mobile phone to a greater extent, but with a lot more assurance, a lot more resilience. We've been lucky enough to be selected on the current UK ARC programme, which is really starting to look at how these new technologies are deployed in faster, more assured wireless communications. So that's around things like secure wireless headquarters, being able to stand up and deploy it at huge speed rather than having thousands of miles of cables and 2 or 3 days.
Tactical data links and other networking technologies will also play a key role in the broader connectivity space.
We talked to Defence about tactical data link technology, where often there's a lot of technology there, but it's not joined together in the right way. And then as you begin to link all of the tactical data links across the battle space, it begins to drive into things like small form-fit tactical units that fit into air platforms and into ground platforms, you know, handheld solutions that begin to open up joint fires and air-assisted solutions at huge pace. You know, we've recently released our press release on the UHF SATCOM onto the Type 31 frigates. So that puts us on all boats across the Royal Naval Fleet. And again, it's the use of the UHF because it offers data as well as handheld, and that's a growing anti-jam capability. Space as the new domain, one of the two new domains is incredible. So it's beginning to offer assured space capabilities across the entire globe at huge pace. It's beginning to drive freedom of sovereign actions, but also a broader integration with allies, where it's mixing the benefits of those broader private sector as well as military networks. We start to look at ViaSat-3 as it approaches launch, where it's capable of offering, you know, virtual private networks in space that can be segregated from the private sector to the defense sector, having their own network and moving hundreds of megabytes of data from these 1 terabyte per second satellites. Globally, it offers the ability to, you know, take an amount of traffic and have it running 100% in one country, and then 15 minutes later having it run at 50% capacity across two different countries on the other side of the world. So I think these things are starting to throw up the capability and the commercial challenge to Mod in what it wants to do.
Underneath these innovations and driving the evolution of Sunrise capabilities is data, the need to understand it, interrogate it, and use it in the most effective way. Behavioural changes will empower defence in the UK to increasingly focus on its mission, relying on trusted partners in industry more than ever before. Let's turn to Beeching again for the final word.
I think the other thing that comes with this movement is this change in the industrial base. I think the concept of, you know, mega primes is beginning to become outdated. So as you walk into this hybrid fused procurement model where the platform is one element, but the technology and the mission thread and the communications and the capability becomes the other, I think you're beginning to see much more ecosystems of partners, industry working together in more collaborative ways. And I think as that's driven by Mod through the requirement of missions, it starts to make industry stand front and centre. And instead of relying on specifications to drive change control, we take ownership with our customer of how we integrate those solutions, how we use our partners to deliver a mission thread rather than to deliver a box. That's going to create freedom for Mod. And, you know, we've been doing this with many areas. I mean, ARC, we've got multiple contractors and partners and suppliers working with us. We've got our customer fully engaged, and we're bringing the best available into each of those solutions and offering alternatives that build into this standard architecture. I view this as the start of a road, but really to get the most out of it, we need MOD to move into this demanding, please deliver the mission, sharing the mission, trusting the industry aren't going to abuse that sharing of the mission, and then selecting partnerships that create these force multipliers.
Next time on Five Eyes Connectivity, we turn our attention to two of the other players in the Five Eyes Alliance, Australia and New Zealand, and discover how these allied nations are positioning themselves to meet the threats of the future. How do smaller nations with more limited resources ensure their armed forces remain effective and relevant in a rapidly changing world? That's next time on Five Eyes Connectivity, available soon wherever you get your podcasts. The Five Eyes Connectivity podcast was created by Shepherd Studio in partnership with our sponsor, Viasat. To learn more about Viasat's support to the Five Eyes nations, visit fiveeyesconnect.com for capability profiles, white papers, videos, and more. This episode was produced by Tony Skinner, with research support by Jack Austin, script writing by Jared Cowan, and audio editing and mastering by Kevin Stokes. A big thanks to everyone who gave their time to support the project. Until next time.